Water companies are legally allowed to discharge untreated wastewater into rivers and seas during exceptional rainfall. This stops sewage backing up into people's homes. But they are suspected of using sewage overflows more than they should, causing dangerous levels of pollution. This can expose swimmers, surfers and rowers to bacteria such as Salmonella and E. coli, which cause diarrhea and vomiting, or viruses like hepatitis A, which can lead to liver infection. Sewage has even polluted our drinking water. In Brixham, Devon last year, residents had to boil their tap water after an outbreak of a diarrhea-like illness caused by the parasite Cryptosporidium found in faeces. Before she swims now, Jo checks an app run by the campaign group Surfers Against Sewage. This tells her when sewage is being discharged into the sea near her favourite South Devon beaches. I was talking to Jo back in July when rainfall was relatively low.
So in Exmouth last year, there were over 120 days when I couldn't swim. And that was across the year. It happens more in winter because it is related to heavy rain, but it isn't only caused by heavy rain. At the moment in Budleigh Salterton, which is where I have swum but won't swim this year, there have been discharges, dumps of raw sewage in Budleigh constantly. I mean, with breaks, but like almost every day this year since January that are still going on now because I believe it's due to a problem with the holding tank.
Water companies are accused by campaigners of failing to invest in infrastructure. This has left sewage systems unable to cope, even in normal weather. Campaigners argue that customers' money is being used instead to pay billions of pounds in bonuses to company bosses and in dividends to shareholders. Ofwat, the body that regulates the water industry jointly with the Environment Agency, refutes those claims. It insists that over £200 billion has been invested since the industry was privatised more than 30 years ago. It does agree, however, that change is needed. The water companies say they can fund the necessary improvements by increasing bills. But proposed price hikes have outraged consumer watchdogs and campaigners like Jo.
Literally millions and millions of pounds are paid every year in dividends, in bonuses. That money should have been going into the infrastructure, and it hasn't been happening.
So why did you decide to pursue a legal case? It's a bit of a David and Goliath battle, isn't it?
It is. Well, it kind of didn't really seem like that, but the more time's gone on, it does seem like that. Early last year, I decided to stop paying the sewage element of my water bill. And so, of course, I was then threatened with county court judgments and bailiffs and all of that sort of thing. So I actually gave into it because it was quite frightening. I didn't want those things. And I thought, okay, you know, pack it in. You've made your point. But I then went through the summer, and even though it was summer and it didn't rain as much, there were still sewage spills, not as many, but they still went on. And they, you know, so towards the end of the year, I thought, right, don't be a wuss. Go for it. Do it again. Don't cave in. So I decided again I would stop paying the sewage element. But it just wasn't enough. I still felt something bigger needed to be done. At that point, it was really only about me. It didn't seem like this huge thing. And I finally issued my claim just through the small claims court.
It cost Jo £50 to make the claim, asking for £379.50 compensation for not being able to swim due to sewage. She says it's obviously not about the money, but about making a stand. Her case, which is ongoing, soon attracted national media attention and thousands of supporters on social media.
After moving to Exmouth 5 years ago, Jo Bateman found that a daily dip in the sea had a transformative effect on her mental health.
Yeah, but after a swim started to become frequently disrupted by sewage spills, she decided to take action.
She now has backing from the legal campaign group, The Good Law Project, and leading law firm Lee Day. She has also inspired a group of residents in Exmouth, her hometown, to launch their own legal action against South West Water.
I had never in my wildest dreams anticipated anything like that happening. So it is sometimes stressful, but at the same time, it's happened, and I feel like I just have to keep going with it for as long as it takes now. I'm not backing down now.
As well as threatening our health, sewage pollution is also causing environmental damage to our waterways, devastating many areas of natural beauty. Lake Windermere in the Lake District has turned green in some parts due to an overgrowth of toxic algae, and the once crystal clear waters of many of England's rare chalk streams are now murky and grey. I wanted to understand more about how this extraordinary scandal has developed. The story begins with Margaret Thatcher back in 1989 insisting to a rowdy House of Commons that privatising water will be a success.
Privatised water is a better deal than nationalised water. That the water privatisation, I believe, will go very successfully indeed. That will go very successfully indeed. And perhaps therefore we had better wait and see so that we can pontificate in the light of the fact.
To find out what happened next, I arranged to meet two academics in the LSE IQ studio. It's a small room on top of a 12-storey tower block with spectacular views across London. It was a clear, bright day, and as I waited for my guest to arrive, I could see the River Thames glistening in the distance. It was a sobering thought that Thames Water had pumped 14.2 billion litres of sewage into it the previous year. Joining me in the studio were Professor Gwyn Bevan, an LSE policy expert, whose latest book is called How Did Britain Come to This? A Century of Systemic Failure of Governance. And Dr. Kate Baylis, an economist from the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. She has been researching the UK water industry for the past 10 years. I started by asking Kate how well the state-owned system had been operating before Mrs. Thatcher's radical programme of privatisation.
These regional water authorities were facing financial problems. There was a need, huge need for investment in the sector, and there was considerable pollution. So we needed investment in the water sector, but the government was reluctant to commit more government borrowing or to increase taxes. So privatisation was happening in other sectors, and so privatisation of water came to the fore as a suitable policy. It was supposed to make companies more efficient because of the profit motive, and private companies would then borrow to invest and it would take the debt off the government's books. But also there was a political agenda to create a sort of new class of conservative voters that would be share owners, because some of the shares were reserved for water company customers. So it was like a deeper cultural shift in the economy that the water privatisation was part of.
Gwyn, you talk about this in your book about neoliberalism and the radical changes made to public services.
The key idea of neoliberalism at the heart of Margaret Thatcher's governments is that the best form of organising things is private ownership in markets. And she firmly believed that state-run enterprises, you know, and public services, they lack the incentives for efficiency. The confidence trick that neoliberalism performed is to persuade people that markets and private ownership are the solution. But actually, there are very stringent conditions, which is what my book explains, where markets work. I mean, they work really well for simple commodities like bread. We buy it often. It's cheap. You don't write a contract. If quality is terrible, you stop buying it. Failing providers exit the market. A whole set of things. And the key thing that makes markets work is competition and failing providers exit. Now, the water companies always classically the exemplar of where markets won't work because you've got a natural monopoly. And of course, water and sewage are vital for health and life and health.
Can you just explain what the whole natural monopoly?
Basically, you know, the water comes from one set of reservoirs through one set of pipes. And if you wanted to have competition, another company have to, you know, develop new reservoirs and a new set of pipes, and it would be hugely expensive. So we just see that as a natural monopoly. It's unlike, say, in private markets where a firm manages to achieve a monopolistic position, but actually there are other firms that could easily enter the market.
Plus the fact it's water and it's homogenous. There's water's water. You can't have, other than having good quality water, it's not much to define different types of water.
Yeah.
We all need water and sanitation in our homes, but there is only one company in each region that can provide it. So it's a monopoly business with captive customers. This means there is no competition, so less incentive to invest in infrastructure and provide the best service. It seems obvious now that this might create problems, but at the beginning, it all ran smoothly. Gwyn told me that privatisation seemed to work at first. Each water company in each different region appeared to be operating responsibly, overseen as they are today by the regulator Ofwat. But it didn't last long.
In the early 1990s, I was working for a firm of economic consultants that was doing really well on the back of consulting for privatisation. And they described Ian Byatt, the regulator Ofwat, as chief executive of UK Water PLC. And it's felt he had this iron grip on those companies. There were these ground rules for financial probity of those companies that then disappeared through private equity.
So can you explain what changed and why?
Initially, there was a lot of investment. But since privatisation, we've seen a major change in ownership structures. So we have 10 regional water and sewage companies in England and Wales. I have to emphasise, we're not talking about Scotland and Northern Ireland. They have their own separate public companies. So initially, these were all listed on the London Stock Exchange. So we had a dispersed set of shareholders.
So ordinary people bought
shares. Anyone could buy a share. Yeah, so anyone could buy a share. But since then, initially there was a golden share held by the government until 1994, which was specifically to guard against hostile takeovers.
What does golden share mean?
It's not a controlling share in terms of value. I think it was 15%, but it has properties which mean that they can have a say in takeovers. So it was to protect against like hostile takeovers. So that was in place for the first 5 years. But after that was sold, there was quite a quick process of consolidation. So quite a few companies were taken private, meaning that all the shares were bought by one investor or a consortium of investors.
The government had prepared the water industry for privatisation by cancelling its debts and injecting cash into it. So even though it was sold for £7.6 billion, the net proceeds to the Treasury were roughly zero. Polls showed a big majority of the population were opposed to the policy, but that didn't stop more than 2.5 million people applying for shares. The offer was nearly six times oversubscribed, and the average gain to investors on the first day of trading was 40%, in line with the large premiums from previous privatisations. As small investors sold their shares to cash in their big profits, the water companies were bought up by global enterprises. They are now owned by a complex web of foreign investment firms, wealth funds, and tax haven-based businesses. A guaranteed income from customers and light regulation has made the industry very attractive. It has enabled investors to load the companies with debt and pay out large dividends to shareholders, rather than invest in sewage infrastructure. Kate and Gwyn say water companies have become financial assets for global private investment, rather than operations for the delivery of a vital resource. They call this the financialisation and securitisation of the water sector.
So now, the 10 big water and sewage companies, we have one Welsh Water, which is owned by a not-for-profit company. Three are still listed on the London Stock Exchange. That is Severn Trent, United Utilities. And South West Water is owned by a company called Pennon, and that's listed on the Stock Exchange. We have two that are owned by what I call Asian conglomerates. So Wessex Water is owned by a Malaysian company called YTL. So this is a sort of family-controlled big company with a global portfolio in utilities. And Northumbrian Water is similar. It's owned by CKI, which is owned by a Hong Kong family-based company, but a huge global company. And then we have four of these water and sewage companies owned by consortia of financial investors. So these are pension funds, private equity funds, sovereign wealth funds. These come together for the specific purposes of buying a water company. They set up what's called a special purpose vehicle, SPV. So they set up this company. Out of the four of them, three of these are registered in Jersey. So this company is set up just for buying the water company. And these types of investors have led to a different type of financialization, I suppose, of the water sector.